Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey and as always I'm joined by my co-host Luke Gutfirth and special guest, the fifth Sci Guy Noah Vince.
Hey!
It's fifth Sci Guy Noah, I'm afraid it doesn't change, but this week we're talking about sexy science and quirky coitus.
Finally.
But first, I have a question for you all. Do you know about Patreon?
I do.
Yeah, we have some patrons. They voted for this topic. It's the science of kinks. That's what we're doing. And that's why the question that I'm asking to everyone who's watching and listening and interacting with this in any way to get down to the YouTube comments and answer this question. You got any kinks? Like, what's your kink? Let me know.
Inappropriate.
You guys got any kinks?
Not really. I'm very boring.
Yeah, I used to think I had a blood kink.
I
had a real big... I started testosterone and I developed this massive crush on Bill Skarsgård. And he had several films where he was covered in blood and having sex. And
I thought you said a bug kink.
No, blood.
Okay.
No, he just had sex covered in blood and I thought it was the blood that was hot, but it was just Bill.
You had a Bill Skarsgård
kink. Yeah, I don't find him hot now. That was a whole phase.
Well, let's just talk about kinks in general and leave that blood one behind. So my question to you all now is... what is a kink?
Ooh, I'd imagine it's like a non-normative sexual interest.
Interesting. So if someone were to be attracted to you, that would be an...
Is that... but would that be the definition of a fetish?
Ah!
Or is a kink different?
I'm glad that you brought that up, because what I'm going to tell you now is the difference between a kink and a fetish. So first off, a fetish. A fetish, generally, it's a fixation, a sexual fixation on a specific thing. So it could be an object or a sort of act. It could be, you know what I mean? You have a general idea of what fetishes can be, right? So you could have a fetish for, you know, feet. You could have a fetish for glasses. You could have a fetish for leather. You could have a fetish for, I don't know, candle wax being poured on you. There's any number of
that could be a kink,
that's
though,
really good.
Surely.
Now, yes, it could be a kink.
No. Can we explain? Do you mean in a sexual sense?
No, I don't mean in a sexy way.
Or just dipping your fingers in the candle and picking it off?
Dipping my fingers in candles.
It just sounded like you were like, oh, yeah, that's really good.
It is really good. Dipping your fingers in candles, waiting for it to dry, peeling it off.
Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, you're right. You could just have a kink for any of those things. And I just want to highlight as well, if you've got a fetish for a particular body part, if you've got sort of a fixation on a particular body part, that's called a partialism. And what differentiates a fetish from a kink is a fetish is something where you cannot get off without that thing. Whereas a kink is just an interest. Yeah.
That's actually like...
that is how they're sort of differentiated between each other. I guess colloquially, we kind of just use them almost interchangeably. But that's what I found from sexologists and kinksters and fetishists. That's what they seem to say. That fetishism is, you know, almost being reliant on that thing for gratification.
Whoa. Is it... what? I don't know if this is like going like way too far into the episode or if you're even going to talk about it. But I heard that like a lot of people have foot fetishes because like obviously like you can classically condition yourself to have a foot fetish. But apparently the pleasure part of the brain is like close to where the feet part of the brain is.
A homunculus.
So like would that be why you can't get off, or is it like a psychological thing?
I think when people say they've got a foot fetish, they probably have a foot kink.
Because they probably don't...
Well, they might need feet to get off, but they might be able to get off perfectly fine without feet.
Yeah, I think they probably just enjoy getting off. Well, look, you're almost never going to be having sex with someone that doesn't have feet.
So then,
most people have feet, so they're almost always there.
Would that be considered kind of like, not a disability, but like a struggle if you have a fetish for something that you can't get off without it?
Like a classical fetish.
Like you have a sexual like inability to get off without feet. Or like...
Yeah, we'll get into that. We'll get into that in a bit. So there is an interesting and kind of problematic history of pathologizing your sort of fetishism and kinks and BDSM and all of that sort of stuff. And I kind of want to talk about that in a bit. But let's get back to what kinks and fetishes are. So a fetish is obviously something that, you know, you need it to get off. You've got almost a reliance on that for sexual gratification. Whereas a kink is way broader. It's kind of a fingers and thumbs deal. you know, all fetishes are kinks, but not all kinks are fetishes. In
and
the same way that
some of them are fingers and thumbs.
Yes, sure. You could have a, you've got a finger fetish and a thumb kink. No, what I mean is that, you know, all thumbs are fingers, but not all fingers are thumbs.
Okay. Right?
So all fetishes are kinks, but not all kinks are fetishes.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You understand?
So what is the definition of a kink?
So a kink is... A kink is just sort of an alternative sexual interest, I guess. I don't really want to say deviant, but I guess you're kind of what you were saying
deviation.
Earlier.
Deviation from the norm.
Yeah, deviation from the norm. Non-normative to some degree.
But like a lot of people have the same kinks, so yeah. Could it be that abnormal? That's interesting. So like the difference is just that like a kink is an interest, whereas a fetish is like a requirement to like finish the job.
That's generally the sort of differentiation. Okay. Now, with a fetish, it might not be a case of you absolutely are entirely unable to. That's the definition that I found, that you need it. You need it for sort of full gratification. But I don't know how much leeway there is in that. You know, whether you're able to get off, but it's just not nearly as enjoyable as with the sort of fetish object or, you know, obsession of that fetish.
Are we going to learn about how like kinks are developed?
No, because we've not really studied a lot into that. That's what we're going to be talking about.
Okay.
Because I mean, it is really interesting. I started looking into this and I found out a lot about how we sort of study this. And it's not the way that I thought we would. I thought we'd have had a lot more research on these topics. But the sort of recent research papers, all of them start off with there's been a lot of interest in BDSM as a sort of non-normative sort of paraphilia, a sort of, a sexual disorder, right?
Disorder?
Yeah, well, genuinely. In the DSM-5, a lot of these things are in the DSM-5, which is the sort of big book of mental health issues.
What hasn't been in the DSM-5?
All right. I mean, the three of us have been in the DSM-5 at least like five times over each.
I've got
right?
my own page.
It's just, if you're a look cut for...
Oh my God, you do.
You probably haven't.
I'm in there as a whole thing, and also as a non-normative sexual attraction, according to Corey's edition of the DSM-5.
So those are kinks and fetishes. Are we happy with the sort of definitions of kink and fetish? Do we have an idea of what they are?
Yeah.
Wait, can I just double check?
Go for it.
All kinks are fetishes.
No,
all fetishes are kinks.
All fetishes are kinks.
Okay, fine.
Yes, but not all kinks are fetishes. So a kink, you know, you could enjoy, I guess, sort of candles or candle play, right? You can enjoy getting, you know, hot wax poured on you, and it's like a nice bonus, but it's not a requirement, right? It's kind of, whereas if it was a fetish, like that'd be, you're using that to get off every single time.
That sounds so tiring.
Yeah, right?
You can't just knock a quick one out. You just got to get the candles.
Candles should be available in NHS.
It's a sexual disorder.
Stop this. Stop this. Right. No. We're putting a stopper on this now and we're moving on.
Getting a prescription for candles.
Look, I'm putting my foot down. If you two don't behave...
Oh, that's hot, man.
If you don't behave, Noah is not coming back on the podcast ever again.
We know that's not true.
So let's talk about kink and fetishism in science. I've got a little quote here for you. Historically, these practices and interests have been pathologized. Kraft Ebbing pioneered in classifying sadism and masochism as pathologies in his Psychopathia Sexualis, a reference work of 19th century sexology. These views were later reflected in Freud's theories on sexuality. The perception of BDSM as being pathologic influenced scientific articles from the 1970s and 80s, which tended to focus on non-consensual sexual sadism from a forensic perspective and incidental sadomasochism-related fatalities. So, essentially, if you look at the history of studying kink and fetishism and BDSM, it's almost entirely through the lens of BDSM, which stands for...
Sadism, masochism, bondage, daddy, sad, max.
Yeah, that's it. You nailed that.
But bondage,
This is great listening, isn't it?
Well, someone cut in, right? There's two of you. You know any letters that start with D? Words.
Well, maybe it's the D in bondage.
Bondage, sadism and masochism.
It's bondage, dominance.
Dominance!
Yeah.
I knew it was somewhere.
Yeah. And essentially... You've only really viewed fetishism through the lens of BDSM, which doesn't really encapsulate all kinks no. and all fetishes, right? And it's only been viewed for a long, long time, up until the 70s and 80s, basically through an entirely negative context. So through non-consensual context or through forensic context, you know, so only when sort of crimes have been committed. It's just kind of ridiculous. It's very normal. You know, I say normal as in it's pretty normal to have a kink, right? I mean, a kink is almost inherently sort of a deviation from the norm in yeah. terms of your sexual interest. But having a kink in and of itself is relatively normal.
Well, I guess the question would be whether having a deviation from the norm is a deviation from the norm.
Yeah.
Right? Whether it's more normal to have any one deviation from the norm, like, or is it more normal being in the average mathematical sense, mm-hmm. to be like complete vanilla. I don't know the answer. I don't know what the statistics are.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics are tough, actually, because, again, the studies that have been done on this have largely been done through the lens of BDSM. And on top of that, there is a degree to kink, right? Like, you can be someone that is into kink. You could be one of those people that, you know, sort of has the sort of leather dog mask on whenever they go to Pride, and, you know, they live their life in a sort of a dom and sub situation. You can have someone that sort of has their whole life through the lens of fetishism and kink. Yeah. And then you could have someone who's got a bit of a kink for, you know, I don't know. I keep on going back to candles. I don't know why.
Choking.
You've got someone who's got a choking kink.
I find it interesting that, like, it's only viewed through, like, crime and criminals, and, like, that kind of makes sense, because I feel like back in the day people wouldn't go around boasting about the fact they like to be choked.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah,
it makes sense why
now
there's
they
like.
Love talking about
no,
it.
I
well,
know
he's got
that,
the
like,
internet now.
Yeah, but it makes sense that it wouldn't have been really studied because it was seen as a deviancy.
We're getting more studies now, but I mean, I was looking at ones from 2021 and 2019 that were, you know, meta-analyses that were looking at lots of different studies, and it's kind of sparse in, you know, in some areas in looking at how they form and looking at them less as a sort of psychiatric condition, as a thing that is wrong with someone, and looking at them more as, hey, let's try and understand this aspect of human sexuality.
Yeah.
You know,
it'd be so interesting to see the differences in cultures and kinks.
Yeah,
like, wouldn't that be such an interesting study to be like, oh, does this exist over there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess probably just through my lack of exposure to other cultures, but kink seems like something that's, it only fits in Western culture in my head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, obviously I know people around the world can have kinks, but the kind of kink and fetishism that exists, you know, here,
yeah,
I can't imagine existing elsewhere in the same way. So, for example, I mean, people living their entire lives, with sort of kinks and fetishes, you know, going to pride parades with the dog mask. And leather daddies and all that sort of stuff. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
I guess it depends if kink is something, well, it's probably a bit of both, but if it's something genetic or if it's something sort of like a reaction to, if it's a reaction to, say, Western Judeo-Christian culture and its attitude to sex and then a sort of inversion of those things, then it could be. It could very much be, but if it's something like what Noah was saying, where, like, for example, a foot fetish or a foot kink is due to, or possibly due to, the close proximity of the wiring for the foot being too close to the, like, to being close to the wiring for the genitals on the homunculus in the brain, then that's a genetic factor, and so. Yeah, but it's probably both. And you can probably be predisposed to a kink and then not actually have it expressed due to your upbringing, or be not genetically predisposed to a kink and be raised in a Judeo-Christian, very sex-obsessed, as in the opposite of sex.
Obsessed,
like modesty, like prudy culture. And then you have a reaction in reverse to that and you get really kinky because you're like, screw this whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to make it seem as though I'm saying no one in other countries can have kinks. That's not at all what I think. I'm just pointing out a weird little bias that exists in my head. And I think it's really important to sort of consider this, because culture can have a massive influence on kink and fetishism and all of that stuff, because it's so modular. It affects so many different aspects of our lives. It really affects who we are. And a lot of these studies are bringing up one specific aspect of culture from the past sort of, decade or so.
Okay.
Can you guess what it is?
One bit of culture. The
one
internet?
Specific,
porn?
One very specific work that has influenced the public perception of BDSM.
Yes, of course. That thing about the rich businessman being whipping a young employee of his or something. What's it called?
What?
Fifty Shades of Grey.
Oh, yeah.
I've not read the full thing. So, but something along those lines of rich businessman, young woman, and then they get into whipping.
It's Twilight fanfic.
Yeah.
That's insane how much of an impact just like one book series has had on like people's sexuality.
It's shocking, honestly.
No, I remember when it came out, like all the news articles about there like being like wet cucumbers left in the in the cinemas.
It's like mums and their friends.
Because people would go and, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. Yeah.
It's like mums and their friends reading the books and then passing the books around to each other.
Why leave it?
You don't want to walk out in the, like it's dark in there. You don't want to walk out with a used cucumber.
In your handbag.
That's true, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I personally wouldn't do either of those things, but.
Take it with you. I just feel like that's disrespectful. You do you, man.
100%,
yeah. It just feels a bit cheeky.
I think people probably left the wet cucumber there as a joke.
Right.
Rather than actually, because you wouldn't leave a used cucumber. Would you?
I mean, people use used condom. I've been in a gay club bathroom.
I'm surprised they used a condom. Good for them. Safety first. But no, I mean, 50 Shades was like Harry Potter, but for middle-aged women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I suppose that's just Harry Potter nowadays, right? No. But seriously, like, it took over the world. It was like a Pokemon phenomenon. That level is what it felt like. And to see it being referenced in multiple scientific papers is insane.
Yeah.
You know, and they bring it up because it makes sense. This has influenced the sort of the view of BDSM in the wider culture, but also 50 Shades is a terrible, like absolutely abysmal representation of kink and fetishism and BDSM, because a lot of it does not deal with consent. Which is a massive part. If you speak to anyone that's sort of, they're called kinksters. Let's call them kinksters. That's
kinksters.
A fun name. You know, kinksters or fetishists or people that are really into BDSM. A massive part of that for them is consent. Like those people that are, you know, that are so, that are into that kind of sex are so up on that. You know, they've got all of these sort of like, all of these sort of, I guess, processes for, you know, like sort of dealing with those sort of emotions. Like there's this whole idea of aftercare and whatnot.
Yeah.
Like BDSM, whilst it may seem sort of violent and rough and all of that sort of stuff, at its core, it is built on consent and mutual enjoyment.
I was going to say, like, I follow a few people on Twitter. They're like, the kink community. It's like a whole community. Mm-hmm. It's like a lifestyle for some people.
So moving on from, you know, BDSM and kink and fetishism, I kind of want to talk about paraphilias for a second, because it's really tied in the literature. They're tied together. Despite the fact that they're not necessarily the same thing, they are tied together. Do you know what a paraphilia is?
I love parrots, man.
Philia means like love, I guess, or like... Para is like an object, like paraphernalia, like
paranormal.
So
unusual likes.
Yes. Okay. So essentially, they're. I'll just read out the quote here. Paraphilias are persistent and recurrent sexual interests, urges, fantasies, or behaviors of marked intensity involving objects, activities, or even situations that are atypical in nature. And it says that they're not. It's not inherently a pathological thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, a paraphilia isn't inherently, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you've got like some psychiatric problem. But when we talk about paraphilias, we generally are talking about the psychiatric conditions that fall under that sort of category.
Okay. Wait, so when you say pathological, do you mean like there's like something wrong?
Yeah. So
when
I say pathological, what I mean is sort of not just, so you can have something that's non-normative, but fine. And then you can have something that's sort of non-normative and kind of maladaptive and generally bad for you or others around you.
So what's the difference between a paraphilia, by the definition you've given, and a kink or a fetish? It's like a non-normative philia. You like something that is non-normative.
Yeah, I mean, I guess paraphilia is probably slightly broader than kink. I think kink is more about sort of, you know...
Is it a case where the actual etymology of the word... non-normative like is not actually how we use the word anymore?
Do you know what, to be honest, I'm not sure what the differentiation between those two is. I think and I'm just going to go out on a limb here, I think they both largely mean similar things. However, paraphilia is
more
kind
specific.
Of much broader.
Oh
yeah, well it's much broader in some ways, in that you can conceivably see how kinks can fall under the paraphilia banner.
Yeah.
Right.
But you wouldn't say that... we'll go through some of these some of these paraphilias. We'll go through some of them. You can see how some of them...
Like you don't have a kink for dead bodies.
We That's wouldn't a, describe
would
it as
a,
that.
Yeah, that would be a paraphilia.
Yeah.
But it's not a... It's sort of...
But it is.
It is
kind of is, but we don't describe it like that.
It's a cult situation again.
It's a cult.
It's a cult situation again. In that the I don't mean it. This we're dealing with cult. I mean it's the same as the word cult. We use the word cult to refer to essentially religions that are bad.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know we can have something like Scientology, which one could accurately describe as a cult, but you can't because they've got money and they'll stop you from doing that.
Yeah.
That's why they're not a cult.
Right.
Yeah.
But they are. What stops Mormonism from being a cult? I don't, like, you know what I mean? There are definitions for cult.
Right.
But a lot of it is this. A lot of what sort of differentiates between a cult and not a cult is
how good we think it is.
Yes. How willing
so
we are to
value
put up with
judgment.
It.
Yeah. Value judgment involved, and I imagine there's some. Is there some level of controversy about that? Because you're putting a value judgment on something, or is it just generally like, well, these ones are illegal?
Well, yeah. So this is what I mean. There are some paraphilias that are far, far worse than others.
Sure.
And I mean, again, grouping them all together, I think is it has benefits and it has downsides. And when it comes to kink versus paraphilia, I think that they're largely similar words that are used in entirely different contexts, right? So paraphilia is more sort of a medically sciencey word, whereas kink we use more colloquially.
They're the harmless ones that we want to normalize. No?
Well, I mean, a lot of kinks are harmless and they're fine, but also people use kink to refer to things that can be harmful. You know, I mean, it's just...
Right,
it,
okay,
they're just broad words that describe...
Yeah.
This is the issue. When you're trying to describe something that's just, hey, you don't do things in exactly the same way as we'd expect everyone else to do it.
Yeah.
Here's a word that here's a label we apply
what
to
I
you.
Mean is it is perfectly possible to carry out a kink, like a kink for acting like you're an animal, or a kink for feet, mm-hmm. or a fetish for feet, or whatever, in a consensual and non-harmful way, as the community has practiced mm-hmm. and is so on top of it. But there are paraphilias, like a fetish for dead bodies, a fetish for children, mm-hmm. whatever, that cannot be really... They cannot be carried out in a way that is harmless.
Oh, no, necrophilia can be carried out in a way that's harmless.
Don't open up this conversation.
Okay, right. How can it be carried out in a way that's harmless?
Look, I think this is a situation of... kind of whether we view dead bodies as objects or as a tier above object. And put it this way, if you were to consensually leave your body to, you know, like, hey...
And some people do that. Some people say a cannibal can eat me if they want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because, look, put it this way, we have a lot of attachment to dead bodies for good reason, right? Just speaking as an animal that is evolving, it is probably good to have certain feelings towards dead bodies,
mm-hmm.
you know, to want to bury them because... If you don't, you might get sick,
mm-hmm.
or you might attract, you know, some predator or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's a good idea to do the things that we do around dead bodies. And then we've built sort of culture around that. Yeah, absolutely. We've built culture.
Sorry.
Thanks for mentioning
relevant.
That.
Yeah. It's relevant. No, it's relevant. It's a paraphilia.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've built a sort of culture around that, right? And so when someone has a sexual attraction to dead bodies, now we see that as being like really, really bad. And I'm not saying that, hey, pro-necrophilia over here. All I'm saying is that when it comes to paraphilias, that is one that harms the fewest people. Like it really doesn't harm anyone. If you have a dead body where someone has said, when I die, you can have sex in my body if you want. The only reason that we see it as like really, really bad is because of, you know, potential health implications of having sex with dead bodies. And also,
I don't know, that's the only
bloody,
reason why.
No, and it's also pretty bloody disgusting. And more often than not, it's done non-consensually. Which,
right,
you know, there are all of those aspects of it. And I'm not saying that necrophilia is good. I'm just saying, like, it's more or less kind of neutral if you remove those sort of, I guess, arbitrary value that we place upon dead bodies.
It is practicable in a non-harmful way.
Absolutely, yeah.
Technically, yes.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, like...
Yeah, no, actually, you're right. It is practicable in a non-harmful way. Just the majority of people are like, we don't want that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no.
Like, we think it's weird and disgusting, but like, are you harming anyone?
And it is a really interesting. It is. I found there's an episode of the IT Crowd about a cannibal who wants to eat a person, and I think the person's consented to them being eaten. And it is like that episode really. It's a silly comedy show, but it did get me thinking. Like, well, I don't know what it's like to have an urge to want to eat people. Like, that is a really. Like, I can't imagine being born into this world and having an overwhelming want to eat people.
Do you think you're born with it, though?
Well, I don't know, but you could. Regardless of whether you're born into the world or if you, through some set of circumstances, you are present day, you have this want to eat people. Yeah. What do you do about that? Like,
this is the
thing. I think
that just sounds like a horrible situation to be in. It just sounds dreadful.
You've really hit on it here, because I feel with a lot of these paraphilias, we view people incredibly for necrophilia, we view people like incredibly negatively because they're doing something that we find disgusting and abhorrent and all of that things, you know, in sort of normal society. But when you actually look at the human element, why are you judging them for doing this disgusting thing? Because like, they really want to do it and they can't control what they want. The solution isn't to, like, say you're disgusting and horrific and blech. It's like, hey, can we, let's help you so that you don't have this and you don't have to deal with this issue that you've got, right? You know what I mean? Especially for necrophilia, where it's just like, who are you going to harm? You know what I mean? Like, it's a dead body.
It kind of comes back to a discussion we have a lot of the time I promise this is relevant, about prison and about people who haven't committed a crime, liking to pat themselves on the back as being a great guy because I haven't committed a crime, and then somebody who's been convicted of a crime, even if it's something like possession of marijuana, or even, as we spoke in a different episode about, they have an impulse control problem, and they've committed a crime. And we like to pat ourselves on the back as not having done that and go, aren't we great guys? Yeah. Top-notch guys. And it's the same thing. But equally, there are certain things like having impulse control issues that make you more likely to do something like that that's not you and your free choices. And it's the same thing as, like, we like to pat ourselves on the back and go, aren't I a great guy relative to this person who wants to eat people?
Yeah.
Ah, look at how great I am. And in order to do that, we have to massively condemn that other person in order to feel relatively good about ourselves.
Yeah.
Even though we didn't choose not to
That's the point.
To eat bodies.
This is where I want to be very, very, very clear on this, because this is a topic where you can be very easily misconstrued and people will take you out of context and all of that nonsense. I'm going to be so clear. Now, having that urge to, say, eat a person or to have sex with a dead body, you cannot control your urges, right? I don't think we should be judging people for that.
Well, you can control your urges.
No.
You can't choose your urges.
What I'm saying is you can't control... You can control whether you act on an urge.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But you can't control that. You can't control feeling that. You know what I mean?
Yes.
In the same sense that, you know, you can't control a lot of the things that you want. If I want, say, a cookie, I can't control whether I want it or not. I already want it. I can just control whether I'm going to get it or not. And so...
Do you?
Not really. No.
You can't even control your urge for cookies. Who are you to judge?
No, but my point being here that what we tend to do is see someone that has an urge that we find disgusting.
Yeah.
And then we basically demonize them for having that thing that they can't control, rather than demonizing the acting upon it.
Whether they act upon it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the acting upon it which is the bad thing, like the really bad thing. Otherwise, it's just like, we should be helping you, because having these very like sort of non-societally sort of acceptable urges, and I don't say non-societally acceptable, you know, to sort of diminish the severity of it, I mean, like, it isn't acceptable in normal society, and it is harmful to people. If you've got those urges, we should be trying to help you so that you don't have them, because you didn't choose to do that.
Yeah,
it's not your fault.
Yeah, and in order to do that, those people need to be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
And they probably cannot.
No.
Because you'll probably get locked up.
No, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's tough, because as soon as you start showing sympathy for people like this, you're then labeled as someone that like is pro the whole thing, which it's just not the case. It's just a case of like, maybe the best way to sort of deal with problems in society isn't to demonize people for things that they can't control, but instead to vilify bad actions and try to help people avoid acting badly.
Yeah, but I don't know what I'd do if I was like in charge of the world. I don't know what I'd do in terms of like if someone wants to consensually leave their dead body to some cannibal.
You didn't do anything.
You what?
It's their dying wish.
No, of course, but you have to. The reality is, you have to create legal frameworks for that kind of thing to happen.
Oh, you and do like, set up like consent forms.
Well,
and,
but
like,
you have to if you're going to condone it. You have to create structures for your society to operate.
Yeah.
For people to be able to, you know, confirm that there was consent and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what I would do, because you definitely wouldn't get that past a government. Like, you wouldn't win a vote in Parliament about
that.
Oh,
no, sure. No. I mean, we're thinking of this ideal world where you manage to get it through, but I would just do a tiered system based on organ donation. So if you're an organ donor, you can opt into being an organ donor for a cannibal. And if
oh my god, what? So you well, hang on.
No.
This is like
so
Canada's
if got,
maple syrup.
If you've got
thing.
Any, if you're basically not it, okay, think about it like Wonky Veg, right?
Oh my god!
Right. Do you know how in shops they started selling Wonky Veg?
If this kidney isn't quite good enough for a transplant, we'll give it to a cannibal.
But no, seriously though, if you've got organs and whatnot that are, you know, too messed up or mangled or whatever to go into a person, or parts of your body that aren't going to be used, you know, for organ donation or for science or whatever, why not just chop them up and chuck them to some cannibals?
Why not, Noah? Why not?
I mean, I'm not saying that we should encourage cannibalism. All I'm saying is that, like,
right,
you can make the argument that would encourage cannibalism and that would be a bad thing. Sure, fine, understandable. I'm just saying that, like, in and of itself, a person eating another person consensually, there are bigger fish to fry, right? Like, it's not the biggest problem in the world.
It's not fish they want, though, is it?
It's organs.
Human is the biggest fish to fry.
Fish have organs.
No, I think a shark's bigger.
Fish can't play organs, no, they don't have fingers.
Is a shark a fish?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, it got gills, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's dolphins.
So there are bigger fish to fry.
Yeah. Very true.
Anyway.
Shall we get back to paraphilias? So I was saying that paraphilias are persistent or recurrent sexual interests, urges, fantasies, or behaviors or marked intensity involving object activities or even situations that are atypical in nature. And as I said, it doesn't necessarily mean that there is some sort of psychiatric condition there. You know, you could just have a paraphilia that isn't then sort of psychiatrically sort of relevant. But some examples of things that are in the DSM-5. There are 8 paraphilias in the DSM-5, and I'm just going to list them off. It's pedophilia, exhibitionism, voyeurism, sexual sadism, sexual masochism, frotteurism, fetishism, and transvestic fetishism.
Sorry?
Hang on, transvestic fetishism is still in there.
That's cross-dressing, that's not transsexual.
Yeah, it's not transsexual, it's cross-dressing. I was confused, and I had to look into this really, really quickly. And I don't know how up-to-date this is, but it was talking about the DSM-5, so it's within the past sort of decade-ish, right? And in the DSM-5, transvestic fetishism is still there. It's essentially, put it this way, it's different than cross-dressing for any other reason. It's just there in the same sense as sort of those issues with sort of sexual dysfunction are in the DSM-5. Now, you could be asexual and not have any distress caused by, you know, your lack of sexual attraction, and so you wouldn't fall into the category, the sort of sexual dysfunction disorders in the DSM-5. And similarly, you could cross-dress and have no distress from it.
Yeah.
You can have the urge to do it and have no distress from it, and so you wouldn't fall into the conditions that are in the DSM-5. The only reason they're in there is for when people do it and, like, it's becoming an issue for them. I'm not saying that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just explaining why it's there.
In what way could it become an issue for them?
In that, like, okay, so, you know, if you're cross-dressing for drag or whatever, that's one thing. But if you've got an overwhelming urge to do it, to cross-dress, and I'm using the term that is being used sort of in the literature there. If you're cross-dressing in, you know, the clothes of, like, you know, another gender, and you have the urge to do it, but you don't necessarily want to, and you've got like a gratification out of it, but you've got like shame and all of like these other things.
Yeah.
that's going to cause distress.
Surely that could just come from society saying, hey, it's not normal for a man to wear women's clothes.
Yeah, probably.
Like, it's a very strange thing to be affiliated. Also, what's frotterism?
I actually have no idea what it is. I didn't look into all of these because, I mean, I didn't want this to be an episode just about paraphilias because I feel like reducing kink down to just the pathologizing of it isn't necessarily the best thing. I feel like there are problems with these things being in the DSM-5, but also it kind of provides a framework for helping people that want help.
Yeah.
You know? It's difficult. But the good thing about the diagnostic criteria for a lot of these is that you're not going to be diagnosed with it unless
it causes distress.
Unless it's causing you distress and you sort of want to be diagnosed with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You kind of, it's almost an opt-in, opt-out kind of thing.
Well, yeah, you're not going to be diagnosed with something unless you go and get a diagnosis.
Yeah, but even in the diagnostic criteria, it literally says, for you know, even for the sort of asexual thing, it sort of says that, you know,
distress.
You can't be diagnosed with this if it's explained by something else.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't, if it's not affecting your life, there's no distress.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not great, and it obviously comes from this history of sort of pathologizing and demonizing these deviant sexual behaviors. Some of them should be pathologized, but others less so, right? So this sort of cross-dressing thing, that's probably more societal than it is.
Like, you just feel maybe a bit embarrassed.
Yeah. I mean, there are some issues apparently for people that have sort of gender, they get like sort of, I'm taking this with a massive grain of salt because I didn't look too deeply into it. It said late onset gender dysphoria, and then started talking about, what is it? Autogynephilia,
which was
absolutely ridiculous. But it was saying that apparently if you have this sort of transvestic fetishism that's become an issue for you, that can be a root cause of late onset gender dysphoria.
Right.
And again, you see the issues with having this in there in that, like, it putting human experiences into little boxes like this and saying there is something wrong with your brain.
Yeah.
It removes nuance and might make it harder for some people to get the help that they need, whilst also making it generally easier to get people help, you know?
This may be ignorant. I don't know. It talks about transvestic fetishism, and transvestite is a word we don't generally use anymore. But I wonder, is there a distinction between sort of wanting to cross-dress for example, for sexual gratification or because you just enjoy it and actually having no issue with your gender whatsoever.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a gender confusion thing. It's more just, hey, I enjoyed getting off while wearing a dress.
Also, that you specifically do believe or have some level of belief in the gender binary and you are specifically identifying as one gender on the gender binary and dressing as the opposite gender because you enjoy that.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, transvestic fetishism, if you just want like a quick definition of it, it is having a sexual or erotic interest in cross-dressing. That is literally just the first line from this paper I've got up here from 2012. It's a weird one, right? It kind of highlights the limitations, I guess, of how we sort of construct mental illness and psychiatric disorders. It very much exists on those sort of boundaries of is this useful or is it more harmful?
Well, I wonder where this would fall for that Little Britain character.
Emily Howard.
Because that, I think when Emily Howard and the other character as well. Because when, you know, the sort of criticism of Little Britain started coming out, and also it specifically in terms of gender stuff and in terms of trans rights and not having bad media depictions of trans people, that Emily Howard stuff was sort of brought up as an example. But to me, I never saw them as trans people because they very much return to their gender and they are very, as far as I can tell, very comfortable in their gender. They just seem to be enjoying dressing as women and acting as women, and then, but without any sort of gender dysphoria.
I think
I'm talking about a character.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think like Matt Lucas and David Walliams like fully thought out the specifics of like the identity. I think they just found it funny.
Yeah.
So those are paraphilias, and you can see how that sort of word, that category, is a bit of an issue. It's kind of putting, it's putting paedophilia next to transvestic fetishism. Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? You know, getting off from dressing in the clothes that society says that you shouldn't dress in is the same as wanting to harm children.
Yeah.
Like, that's not, those aren't really the same kind of thing.
It is,
at
yeah.
all.
And it's interesting how it's like, the cross-dressing thing is purely societal.
Yeah.
Like, it's purely society saying, this is for women, this is for men, if you wear this, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Whereas, like, paedophilia, I feel like, I guess, actually, do we know the origins of, like, people having sexual interest in kids?
People
like,
had
is
sex
it
with kids for a long time.
No, I know, but like, in terms
of,
like,
there used to be a thing in Roman times where, like, there was a hierarchy of men who had sex with younger men.
Oh, yeah, and they were bottoms, and then they grew up, and they were tops.
Yeah.
Weird.
Weird, yes.
Sorry. No, any Romans listening.
No. Very weird. But I oh God, no, I was taught this in high school, so he probably aged them up for us. Never mind.
Oh God.
No, but it definitely weird. But like, there is, I think, a differentiation between that.
Yeah, sorry, and if everyone's over 18, you can have a hierarchy of older men having sex with younger yeah. boys if or younger men if they want to.
Yeah.
And that can be the structure of your society, and it's more or less fine as long as there isn't a massive power dynamic going on.
Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
Oh, God, he won't stop ringing, will he?
Yes, well, he wants to tell us about SciGuys Live, Luke.
SciGuys Live?
Yes, SciGuys Live, the monthly live show where you and I, and sometimes a guest, talk about the science news and facts from the past month.
We also have a meme review where the members of our SciGuys Discord channel have made memes about the show or just brought in external science memes and presented them to us. And at the end of the meme review, we crown a meme lord.
So if you want to be the meme lord and enjoy all the other fun of SciGuys Live, like the quizzes, the audience call-ins, and everything else, make sure you're around at the end of this month and every month for the rest of time.
On our YouTube channel.
Goodbye. No, wait, that's not right.
Back to the show.
Let's get back to the show.
If you insist.
So we've covered those sort of paraphilias, and we've kind of spoken about how they're kind of different to each other in terms of severity and weight and just, like, I guess, harm to society, yeah. you know? And, I mean, I think it's, to be honest, a good thing that some of these things are put under, are in the DSM-5, are seen as sort of psychiatric disorders. Like,
yeah.
for example, like paedophilia or exhibitionism as in, like, flashing, that sort of thing.
Is it just flashing? I thought exhibitionism was enjoying people watching you have
could
sex.
Be dogging,
because it could be consensual.
Sure. Like, no. So exhibitionism in the DSM-5 is not the same as exhibitionism as a concept. So exhibitionism, according to the DSM-5, it's the exposure of an individual's genitalia to unsuspecting strangers for sexual satisfaction.
Oh, that's very specific.
Yeah.
I guess what's so strange about these being the same category is that there's certain ones that, like the transvestic sexual fetish or whatever it was called, that can be carried out without harm.
And then
there are certain ones, like paedophilia and flashing, which cannot be carried out without harm.
Inherently harmful,
And so it's odd to put them in the same category because, you know, like you say, you know, these things will be diagnosed if they're causing you distress, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But there are some that are, you know, there's only going to be distress with the transvestic dressing sexual fat thing if you either do it and wish you didn't, or don't want to do it at all, and so therefore don't. But there's always going to be harm in the practicing of flashing, and there's always going to be harm in the practicing of paedophilia.
Yeah.
That's unavoidable.
No, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting. This is something that is incredibly controversial, so I'm gonna phrase it incredibly carefully. I'm actually terrified to say it on this podcast because I know there is a very solid chance that it's going to be taken entirely out of context. But I want to just mention the way that we view paedophilia generally as a sort of society. So many people have this view of, if you have an attraction to children, you deserve to be stoned to death, that sort of thing. And I completely understand that. My only point is that I think it's probably better for society if there's less stigma around having that paraphilia, and the same stigma around acting upon it. Less stigma about having that paraphilia, keep the stigma on acting on it, and that way people that have it can seek help without worrying about being ostracized, and then you got fewer paedophiles in the world.
Yeah, and I also feel like you're in a safer environment if, for example, like you're living with someone that's a paedophile and they're able to talk to people about it. Yeah. Other people are aware of it. They can look out for it rather than if you just keep it inside your head. You're going to be like, that just seems,
as opposed to just going online and mixing with other people that have the same sort of thing. And that, like, it would be, I think, a net good for society if people took a slight step back from people who have no control over this urge that they've got, but want to not have it.
I think people just haven't heard about people being, like, non-offending paedophiles.
Yeah.
I think that, like... it's a difficult one.
It's an absolute bloody minefield, and so we don't need to dwell on it too long. All I'm going to say is that you know, any kind of interaction with children that way is absolutely abhorrent, unacceptable, horrible, disgusting. Do not f-ing do it. No excuse. Having the urge to do that is something that is out of your control, and you should seek help.
Yeah, and a lot of the time it is due to that being done to you when you were younger anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I guess it's just a case of people's, desires being mismatched with, you know, what feels best. As in, you want children to not be harmed, but it feels absolutely best to treat the people that you think are going to harm children with absolute vitriol. Even if that's not going to actually aid in getting to your goal. You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's just about taking that step back and being rational and being like, okay, let's create a safe space for these people to get the help that they need so that no one gets harmed.
Yeah.
And still treat the people that don't get that. Because then you can actually treat the people that don't take the option to get that help.
Yeah.
However you want to treat them. Like, you can treat them terribly if you want, because they've actually made a bloody choice and not done the work that they could have done.
Well, it's kind of similar to, like, crime and punishment, where, like, committing a crime, yes, bad. Going to jail... You shouldn't be, you know, the aim of jail should be to rehabilitate people. Mm-hmm. And if people are willing to be like, hey, I have these urges, I want to get them sorted out, I feel like rehabilitation is the answer rather than just, yeah.
What's really interesting is there are countries, I forget where it is, but there are countries where you specifically can share it with a therapist, for example, mm-hmm. They can talk to you about it. But there are also countries where if you share it with the therapist is legally obliged to tell mm-hmm. authorities.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's two different ways of dealing with that, which, feels weird.
Yeah.
Disincentivizing having people admit that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
It just feels like a really poor strategy in general. Like, yes, it's not a good thing, but disincentivize people sharing it so that you're aware and can... I either keep an eye on people, or talk to people, or help them. That feels like a fairly reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, but it's a case of out of sight, out of mind, isn't it? You know,
and it's also a case of, I think, this attitude of like, it's almost like that when you said like the idea that people like get stoned to death. Mm-hmm. It's almost like that, like in the past when if you had like a baby that was like slightly deformed, you just killed it.
Yeah,
like that was like the way that you did it, and you know. No one's going to deny that would... Well, it actually wouldn't be a solution. Because if you just took people with those kind of feelings and you just stoned them to death, well, yes, you'd get rid of some of them, the ones you found out about, probably the ones that have already done harm, mm-hmm. but all the ones that haven't done harm yet will just hide.
Yeah.
And then eventually they might do it and they might get into little communities where they egg each other on.
Well, that is what happens.
Is that what happens?
That is what happens.
Well, that's exactly what happens. Yeah, yeah. Like, literally, someone I went to school with got into one of those communities online and did horrific, horrific things.
Oh my God.
And it was, and like, nobody knew, but if he was able to speak to someone, I doubt he would have fallen down that rabbit hole, because he was otherwise, he seemed like, I mean, he was a bit of a but he didn't seem like that kind of guy.
Right.
You know? And I just want to add before we move on to something else here, that it is incredibly dangerous for me to talk about this topic in the way that I am, because despite the fact that I am still absolutely condemning, you know, paedophilia, as I'm condemning it, I'm absolutely condemning it. The fact that I'm saying, hey, maybe the best way to stop this from happening is to destigmatize the urge and just stigmatize the action. Me saying that, there's gonna be tons of like homophobes and transphobes that are going to take me saying that and twist it into me being sort of pro-pedophile because they hate LGBT people. Like, I just want to make clear how bloody big of a risk it is to say this. Like, it's very scary. Like, this is the most anxious I've felt saying anything on this podcast, and I will say a lot on this podcast, you know. So let's move back on to kinks. Why do people have kinks?
Dunno.
Nature, nurture.
Nature and nurture. Yep. That's the two
pretty
answers.
Much everything.
Yeah.
other than, like, I don't know.
Space.
What vegetables they're eating. I suppose that would be nurture still.
That's nurture.
And nature.
Oh.
Yeah. But space is neither.
Is it that they're putting stuff in the water that's turning the frogs gay?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Look, it's not always things that turn the frogs
not
gay.
Not always, but
often.
Sometimes.
Often it is. Yeah.
No, it's not. I want to be very clear. That was a joke. It was a joke. That man is a bad man.
Get kinks from, you know, growing up, having experiences with feet. And, you know, thinking they're sexy. I read the story of some
all
guy
kinks
who...
kinks come from finding feet sexy.
Yeah. But I saw this Twitter thread about some guy. He was like, people are really interested in how I got a foot fetish. And it was really interesting to read. It was literally just like, he was sat in the car and his aunt was in the back seat with bare feet. And he looked at them and she was like rubbing them or something. And he found them really sexy. And ever since then, he's had
feet
kinks.
That sounds like how he discovered it as opposed to how he got it.
I guess.
Yeah, but then the discovering for someone and how someone feels that they got it, those are very similar things.
Yeah,
I
right.
mean, like from a sort of more objective standpoint, obviously those are quite different. But like, you know, if you discover it, you can then kind of nurture it or try to, like, I guess, repress it, you know? And so in choosing to not repress it.
Yeah, there was a thing on Love Island a few years ago where a guy admitted to having a foot fetish and it was a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like, the reaction was like, but then the girl he was with was like, well, because it's non-normative. That's
no, no, yeah, but I know
all
why.
All the kinks you could have. Like, if I was with someone that had a foot kink, I'd be like, okay, kind of weird, but it's not so gross.
But then this is the thing, kind of weird. It's seen as a sort of embarrassing thing. And I'm just like okay, I guess that the people that have a foot fetish can often act in an embarrassing way.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, when they beg for foot pics. And the fact that, you know, Wiki Feet exists.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
if they're
yeah.
that guy from Nickelodeon.
That's horrific.
That's a crossover between paraphilia and kink.
Jesus Christ. That was
and
paraphilia. That's horrific. Yeah.
That was the paraphilia.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I think just a foot fetish in and of itself, that's fine. Let them be. Let them love their love the little feetsies.
I just mean it was on one of the most popular televised things of this guy admitting that he had a foot fetish as like an early stage part of the relationship was like, I need to tell you this. It's a big part of my life. I don't want to freak you out.
Mm-hmm.
And her like accepting that. I don't know whether she then enabled him to act upon it, but she accepted it. And it was on national television. He admitted that on national television. And like that was quite a
brave.
Big deal for normalizing something which is ultimately harmless.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, and that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't think we should stigmatize it. It's the same as stigmatizing furries and stuff. Yeah. You know, like, who are furries harming? Furries are the nicest people on the planet. I have never met...
Furries for president.
I've never met a furry that hasn't been lovely.
Yeah.
They're all just, like, generally really nice people.
All the mean ones, you haven't met them. They don't come outside because they're really mean.
They're really mean. Too mean. But, yeah, no, I mean, I just think that, you know, destigmatizing a lot of these things is probably a good thing. Because, like, who is a foot fetish harming? Who is a furry harming, you know? But, no, what I'm saying is that we should destigmatize that. But that doesn't answer my question, which is, why do people have kinks? And it's a big question, and ultimately, we don't really know exactly why people have kinks, but then, as I said, it's a big question, because no two kinks are necessarily identical.
Yeah, I was
right?
going to say it could be anything.
Yeah, so for example, some of them, I've got this quote from The Guardian, some kinks make like a lot of sense. Here's the quote. Put simply, there's a science to spanking, to nipple torture, to candle waxing, and pretty much any other sex act you could name where prolonging the anticipation of touch or relief or safely manipulating blood flow causes the release of neurotransmitters such as dopamine, adrenaline, or serotonin that result in a chemical high. So, you know, like...
It's the anticipation.
Exactly. And like, you know, edging and, I mean, like sort of that sort of teasing and all of that sort of stuff. It makes sense that people would be into that because anticipation... can feel really, really good. And obviously you've got to be predisposed to being able to enjoy it in the same sense that, you know, some people don't like roller coasters, but other people really love them.
Yeah, but also nipple torture, I feel we just skimmed past that one.
Yeah.
The, that, nipple, how, yeah, how is
the,
that?
The torture part feels like...
I think it's just aggressive nipple play.
But how is that like anticipation? I'm anticipating you to stop, please, now.
Yeah, but there's also, do you know how pain can feel good? Okay, so think about it this way. I really like spicy food.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
I love spicy food. And sometimes it's too hot and it bloody burns, but like, man, I love that heat.
I think it's just a specific nippular area which has me cringing.
Yeah, no,
my
fair.
My nipples hurt anyway.
Like, I don't want my nipples to be crushed or anything. That seems horrific. But like, I can understand why some people are into certain things, because I can see how it would feel good, in the same sense that strapping yourself onto, like, you know, a car that shoots across a metal track and goes upside down and loops around and stuff seems absolutely insane. But you get me to Disneyland, and I bloody love that.
Yeah,
thing.
That feels like a very different method of action, though, because it's adrenaline. But I don't think is the nipple torture the adrenaline of nipple torture?
Oh, it could be, actually.
Yeah,
it
adrenaline, serotonin, dopamine.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay,
all released,
right.
Yeah.
Well, then.
Oh, okay, that
torture my nipples.
Yeah. I will.
Please. Finally, someone.
Ooh.
But yeah, you can see how some of these kinks and these fetishes just make sense in terms of it's basically like a roller coaster ride or eating spicy food. Like, yes, it seems like it's harmful or painful, but we enjoy that in other areas often. Like, why would you go and watch a scary movie? Why do you like to be scared? Because it can be fun.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and we don't question that, but we do question when it comes to sexuality, because when it comes to sex, we are very, very rigid. You know,
yeah.
We've got lots of rules around sex, and we're very particular about what is normal and what isn't normal. And if it's not normal, then it's not okay.
I guess the neurotransmitter thing makes sense for like choking and like torture, as you say, but in terms of like having a foot kink, that's different. That's not like a neurotransmitter thing, is it? That's just like finding a certain body part very sexually appealing.
Yeah,
well,
I mean,
it could be association, or it could be wiring.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's this is the thing. When you look at kink, there are so many things that fall under that umbrella term that there could be many routes to developing a kink.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, association or wiring, like you mentioned, those could be major players involved in that. But like, hey, we're a brain. Like, you know, your brain is attracted to different things, right? You know, generally, you know, men, straight men, are attracted to breasts and butts. And they're, you know, like, generally, that's what they're attracted to. And there's a good reason for that, because, you know, if you're looking for a mate, if your mate has, you know, wide hips,
big boobies,
it's good for bearing children.
Big boobies.
And if they got big boobies, they're good for feeding babies. You know what I mean?
Are like, they? Does that
probably
actually correlate?
I actually don't know. That's
don't
just
know
an assumption.
It does.
All I mean
it,
is
it
that
may just be like a an association.
All I mean is it means you're healthy,
yeah,
and you've got ample fat store and ample breast tissue.
I read it was also like just good to have as a cushion.
Oh, that's great, isn't it?
It's just a
everybody
cushion.
Needs a bosom for a pillow.
Everybody needs a bosom.
That's true.
But yeah, I mean, like you can understand where you know you can kind of just slightly rewire a system or slightly divert it or direct it, right? Because like, how the complexity of being attracted to specifically breasts is insane, right? Like being attracted to specifically breasts on women, that is such a very specific thing. There are so many factors that got to come into that, right?
Yeah.
Because you could be attracted, like you could show a straight guy, like a super straight guy, you know, like a transphobic asshole straight guy, a picture of what appears to be a pair of breasts, right? And then you zoom out and you reveal after he said, "Oh yeah, like I really they're hot. I want to see her." Just you zoom out, you reveal actually it is a man with big flabby boobies,
or and with that thing that
gynecomastia.
Yeah, either one, right? And then suddenly your straight guy is like, "Whoa! I'm no longer attracted to those breasts because they're attached to something that I'm not attracted to."
And then they get aggressive and punch you because you made them think they're gay.
That's very true. Yes, they do that. No, but my point is that, like, you know what I mean? There's got to be so many little things involved in being attracted to certain to certain parts, body parts, and to certain actions and whatnot, that it makes sense that, you know, there are quite a few people that probably divert that elsewhere.
The foot one is interesting to me because it could be like a wiring thing, but then also it's like a forbidden thing as well. Like, feet are supposed to be dirty.
Yes,
and people like dirty, like, this is forbidden, like I shouldn't be doing this. So it could be that as well.
I was going to ask, because you said about when we were talking about creating a national organ database where you give some wonky organs to cannibals.
Sure.
I was thinking about, you said that might increase
cannibalism, yeah.
But I wondered, actually, an aspect to cannibalism might be the fact that it's like forbidden. It might be the taboo, and that being exciting. And I wondered, actually, maybe a nationalized database of organs in which wonky organs go to cannibals, and that's sort of normal, and the cannibal just goes to their pharmacy and picks up their prescription for organs.
It loses its excitement.
Its interest. Well, yeah, I don't know how it works. I've no idea about the psychology of cannibalism.
Look, I want to try it. I want to try human meat. No, hold on, wait, listen to me. Listen.
This is why he's trying to normalize paraphilias. He really wants to eat a body.
No, look, I would try human meat because I'm interested. Right, I wouldn't be going to an organ bank every week.
It's
because
you're vegan. Can ask Rebecca for permission to eat some of me.
Why can't you just give it to me now?
Excuse me.
The permission.
Because I've got to consult with my wife.
Ugh, God.
What if she wants to eat him?
Hmm? That's so true.
Yeah,
that's
well, so then true. You can share.
We can share.
She's not that big.
We'll make a lovely meal.
I'm not going to last. I need to be eaten.
Yeah, I know. There's not enough room for you in the freezer. Sorry.
Well, you're vegan, so it is the only kind of consensual meat you'd be able to get.
That's true, not yeah. why he wants to eat that.
No, but like, it sounds much better.
No, I am genuinely... I'm just curious. It would literally one bite and I'd be good. Yeah. I'd be like, what's this like? Oh, just like pork. Okay, cool. I'm done. Yeah. You know, it's just an interesting experience.
Not for me, but fair enough.
Neither.
No, fair enough. Like, I get it. It's like really, really bloody weird, which is why I'm like, that'd be a laugh, right? If it's completely consensual
I'm
and
not
from a dead
right.
person.
I'm not going to validate it.
Damn.
Don't say right, Luke.
Damn. Okay. Well, I'll just
I said it. Right as in I understand your point. Received and understood, not necessarily condoned.
Yes.
So let's just briefly cover how prevalent all of this is. And yeah, the answer is anywhere from between about 2.2% of men, 1.3% of women, up to, I don't know, just under 50% of people who have engaged in BDSM activities or who this is the thing. It's really difficult to gauge how sort of prevalent kink and BDSM and fetishism is because there are so many different layers to it. You can have the sort of clinically relevant sort of paraphilias. Those will be easier to measure because you've got to get a diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
You could more easily sort of track that. Now, outside of that, you know, you've got people that have paraphilias that are very, very taboo and will not want to come forward with them. You've got the same for people that have got kinks that are taboo or fetishes that are taboo that might not want to come forward with them. But also, like, what sort of defines whether you are a fetishist or into kink or any of that is so fuzzy because, hey, you could have one kink that you don't indulge in very often, but you still have a kink.
Yeah.
Does that count?
I know someone with a kink that is so specific, but it's sort of a modification on a type of, on just what I would consider sort of normative sexuality that I'm not even certain it would, it's very specific, but I'm not even certain it would be considered a kink.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
What is this?
I am not telling you.
Okay.
Sounds like I'm going, I know someone who is not me, but no. It's
but I feel like it's kind of strange to make lines because obviously it's based on what is deviant and what is normal, whereas like I feel like it's becoming way more normal for like vanilla couples to have like slightly kinky sex. Like the amount of people, I think every person I know, not every friend but so many friends I know are just like, yeah, I like being choked.
Yeah.
Like so many people do. And then I feel like that would just become a norm, and then where would the line be moved?
Yeah, I mean, sure, but I mean the thing with being choked is that like you're depriving yourself of a little bit of oxygen. You're essentially, it's the neurotransmitter thing again, right?
To get a little lightheaded.
So as long as you're able to, like, as long as being choked isn't inherently just horrifically, I don't like this
for you.
I think most people would probably be able to sort of, I guess, physiologically speaking,
See the appeal. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's interesting. And as we're becoming more open as a society, I think this is making it easier to study, but also it's hard to study, but a lot better for, you know, just people in general. It's harder to study if you're looking at it as a sort of a paraphilia. If you're looking at it through the sort of stigmatized lens that we've got, then it's harder. And that's kind of the last thing I want to talk about, because there is just a massive stigma still against kink, BDSM, fetishism in science. I mean, like, literally just look at the DSM-5 and the paraphilias that exist there, you know?
Like, yeah. Like what we were talking about on that episode about sexual scripting.
Yeah,
Ian. With Ian, yeah. And they were talking about how if you don't see a sort of, either in media or in people you know, a sort of an outcome for you and your situation, your specific sexuality or a specific kink, and how it can be okay for you, then you almost don't really know what to do.
Yeah.
And you don't know the boundaries and you have no way of acting in the world.
It's like not being given a map.
Yeah.
And being told to traverse a forest, you know?
Yeah. And yeah. Especially if the majority of the time you hear about BDSM, it's like negative, or it's in like, this person's been murdered, or like there was recently a news story where somebody was being convicted of murder or manslaughter.
Yeah.
And his defense was that the girl he murdered, manslaughtered, whatever, was really into choking and that he'd accidentally killed her.
Yeah.
And whether that's true or not, I have no idea.
That's not how you choke.
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah,
just,
I have
just, no idea.
What I mean is, regardless, if you are into choking or you want the idea of you want to introduce choking into a relationship, that might really scare you because, you know, it might, I don't know anything about choking, but it may well be that there's probably safer ways of choking people where it's fine.
Yeah.
And in the same way that you spend your entire, like teenage years, like 16, 17, 18, 19, being terrified you're going to get someone pregnant, and then later in life you find out that getting pregnant is actually really complicated, and you're only pregnant, you're only fertile for like a day. It's like, well, you might think that you're really worried that you're going to kill someone if you choke them, but it's because you don't actually know how it works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And look, let's just do a fun little exercise where we all learn how to choke relatively safely. Not exactly like that.
That's my job.
So I think people think that choking is literally like,
oh yeah,
they think it's like crushing the windpipe. When you do it, like, you just squeeze the sides a little bit.
I see.
It's hard, like, and it's like a little bit of restriction, but it's that's literally how you're supposed to do it.
But then also the girl that was killed, maybe she had a kink for it being done incorrectly.
Or he was really bad at it.
Or he's lying.
Yeah.
But then, he's lying.
But then that's where BDSM being destigmatized is really good. Because, you know, if you're into this, you might not know.
Yeah.
You might, okay, put it this way, right? There is every chance that you're, you know, a young guy or girl or non-binary person, and you meet someone that's older than you and they get you into that, and it becomes abusive and you think it's just BDSM. And something like 50 Shades of Grey, where that's just an abusive relationship, you know, under the guise of BDSM, that's really dangerous. That's not going to happen, though, if there's not much of a stigma against BDSM.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're getting into this and, you know, you can openly talk about it and openly talk about your worries about it. And people will be like, hey, that's not BDSM. That's just abuse.
Yeah.
Drop this person.
Yeah. It's like how the age of consent for gay couples used to be higher because gay sex was seen as more dangerous.
Yeah.
But actually, if you just are taught how to make it work, it'll be fine.
Well,
it is more dangerous if you don't know how to do it.
Sure.
But if you know how to do it, which is the point of education, lots of things are more dangerous if you don't know how to... Using a chainsaw is very dangerous if you don't know how to do it.
Using a pair of scissors is dangerous if you don't know how to use them.
That's very true.
But like, this is, I think, a great place to end this episode on. What we need to focus on is destigmatization just in general. Look at me, I'm doing a little after dark wrap up right here.
I thought you were going to say I'm doing a bit of aftercare.
No.
But really, destigmatizing these things is really important. And education is also super important. And the two kind of go hand in hand, because destigmatization then allows for more education. And
yeah.
You can see that happening with, you know, LGBT people. Like, as it becomes less stigmatized to be LGBT, you're able to have more education for LGBT youth. And the same goes for, you know, kids. Sex education is super important for kids, because that way you don't grow up to be a teenager and worry about getting someone pregnant because you don't really know how it works. And you know what I mean? Like, teaching people all about this stuff is just important. It keeps people safe, and you're not going to be able to stop people from being into kink or BDSM or fetishism
by not
or
teaching
whatever.
Them about it.
No, yeah, you're not going to be able to stop it from existing just by not talking about it.
So it's time to regulate it.
Whoa, no.
Legalize or decriminalize kink.
No. The kinks that are criminal right now should be criminal. That's all I'm saying.
I was making a drug joke.
Yeah,
me too.
I got it.
Okay.
I got it.
But he didn't get it.
He didn't understand. I don't think this guy gets us, man.
It's time for a quick fire quiz.
Ding, 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 ding. Corey doesn't get us edition.
Damn it. I thought that was a good transition away. So the rules for the quick fire quiz are the same as always. I will ask one question. That's one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer wins. What do they win, Luke?
A choking lesson with Corey.
Jesus.
Actually, everyone gets that. It should be taught to everyone.
This is just either you or me is taught how to choke by Corey.
Do you just want me to choke you? Is that
no,
what?
I do not want you to choke me.
Are you going
to
throw?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I do. I have no idea what I like.
Okay, Noah, what is your buzzer? Luke, what is your buzzer?
Ooh.
Oh, that's your buzzer. Very good. I like it. So the question for you both is, name one paraphilia in the deal.
Oh, hang on. He has to finish the question.
Name one paraphilia in the DSM-5.
Ooh.
Luke, you came second. Sorry, Noah. Go for it.
Transvestic fetishism.
Well done, Noah. Good job.
What a legend.
And here is your choking lesson. Luke will be carrying it out.
Yay! Finally. You like this?
Are you feeling my lymph nodes?
Yes, very healthy.
Are they swollen?
Well, that's almost it from us. But before we go, we need to thank all of our new patrons. If you go to our Patreon and join that, you get a whole bunch of awesome perks, like bonus episodes, a whole extra show called After Dark. You get a ton of cool stuff. You get to vote on episodes and submit episode topics like this one. So go ahead and join. Luke, why don't you start us off?
Okay, thank you very much to Ellie.
Thank you to Samia McQueen.
Thank you to the letter J.
Thank you to Ronha.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Ev.
And finally, thank you, Sasha. Wow. What a good little thanks we did today.
Bunch of legends.
Amazing. So if you want to be thanked at the end of a Sci Guys episode, just head to the Patreon and join that. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
You can follow me everywhere at NoOffence, except on Twitter where it's NoOffenAdams and TikTok where it's TheNoOffence.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Adios. Bye.